You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. It's a Beautiful Day is the name of that band. Oh, we're going way, way back in the Wayback Machine. David LaFlame and the group. I think he's the only one still alive from that band.
Oh, no.
Yeah. It was hard life back then for musicians.
Yes. Caller had something to announce.
Oh, he had caught this band back in 68, 69, before he moved up here to Portland. Mm-hmm. He caught him at the Fillmore West. Had to pay a whole $3.50 to get in the door. And he mentioned this is like the later version because it's more guitar. Earlier versions, LaFlame's wife was on keyboard and does some great stuff. I think I've played that on past shows.
Yeah, I
it's
saw
a beautiful
them.
Day with White Bird. They got totally tired of playing that song. It's such a big hit.
I saw them at SOC in 1972 at Southern Oregon College. And boy, they really manhandled you back in those days. They pushed you around as you're
what?
Struggling to get into the theater to listen to the band. And
Those college towns.
Well, they are a rambunctious lot. And finally, there is a... I got very close to the stage, but then I was kind of startled to see there was a sartorial mishap on one of the two lady singers' garb. So...
Well, that must have been interesting.
That was a time when, you know, nobody was worried about that kind of thing.
It was a whole other age back then.
Yeah.
So we have got tickets to give away. This is for Shook Twins. Yes, one of our favorite bands. It's going to be the 6th, which I believe is this Saturday. Or no, yes, this is the 4th month. Yes, April. April 6th, 8 p.m. at Revolution Hall, which is right nearby here. This will be for a pair of tickets. Our number here in the air room, 231-8187. We've got young Adrian. Is that right?
Aiden.
Young Aiden, who comes in after us here, who's too shy to actually speak on microphone. I've got the microphone up there if you want to say hi.
No, thanks.
Okay, good. All right. Fair enough. But he's at least going to let us take him in the air room. He's going to help us out here on the phones. Ooh, we've got a question. Our question is going to be... we've been talking about Murder on the Orient Express. We're going to talk about it some more. Movie, 1974. Who played Hercule Poirot in the 1974 version of Murder on the Orient Express? So call us up, 231-8187. We're going to take the second caller. We'll get the pair of tickets to Shook Twins, which we will play again right here.
Have it on speed.
Got campfire songs and mason jars. Love lost ones tattooed on our arms. Vitamin D and elbow grease on.
have a winner. We do have a winner. Shook Twins, and we do have a winner. Who did we get?
It was Mr. Glenn Kennard of Portland, Oregon. He will be going to see the Shook Twins this April 6th at 8 p.m. at Revolution Hall.
And young DK, what was the answer to our question?
Peter Ustinov.
No, you are not going to see Shook Twins. It was Albert Finney in the 1974 movie. We like to say hi to Kelly, who's calling. He lives out in Sirius East Burnside, but he's working down in Milwaukee. He had the correct answer, but he was like the fourth caller. And we want to say hi to Dave down in Oregon City, who's been enjoying the show. Hey, Dave. Hello.
Yay.
Salute.
And actually, our winner had an interesting story for you guys. He used to listen to the Clam Toms when they were busking on the street back in Old Town, Oregon.
Oh, my goodness. Let's have some Clam Tones right now.
That sounds great.
Lord, 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 have you ever been down? Ought to know just how I feel. Just like it broke down engine, I got no driving wheel. Ain't got no drive. Begin to buzzin', the bubbles rush up like mad. Right there you got something to help you out when you ain't got nothing to brag about. Church up, they call on me to preach. I said I ain't on that gal of mine.
Some people say that the blues, they ain't nothing. The blues ain't nothing bad, but they must not have meant them blues. The blues I had, oh, they must not have meant. The blues I had, oh, they must not have meant them blues I had. My buddy, silly sorry Jack, from way up the slide track, he went down, he was sliding, but he can't slide right back. Right there you got something to clue you in when you want the answer to going down. I'm low, I'm low. Thank you.
Uncle Red, and that was Martin Sewald's group there. Before that, the Clam Tones, Jeffrey Frederick's Driving Wheel, and we had our contest. We had Shook Twins doing What We Do, making art out of nothing. That's what they do. And they'll be doing that at the Revolutionary Hall this Saturday. So we have our ticket winner. You're listening to the Monday Sampler. We've got DK Holm from Film at 11, which comes to you on Fridays at 10 o'clock for now. It's just paperwork has to be cleared, rights and everything.
Yeah, we make radio out of nothing.
There we go.
On Friday.
There we go. Young Aiden is also here with us. Hi. He says hi. He's writing it down. He wrote it down and said hi. That's, you know. But it's a new understanding of radio. That's great. Let's see. We were talking about, our question, of course, was who started in the 1974 version of Murder on the Orient Express is Albert Finney. We're kind of talking about that. I found it a very good movie through most of it, the way the scenes moved from one another. I mean, it can be very dull when it's just one person talking to another person in a room.
Poirot was not overdrawn.
No.
As sometimes exaggerated.
Yeah. Though it was a bit of exaggerated, but he's gregarious and he was very charming as portrayed by Albert Finney. I felt that the recent film with Kenneth Branagh, he's totally upstaged by the mustache.
Yeah.
You know, it was how could you make that choice?
It's also the wrong mustache, isn't it?
I don't know. It's like they could make a historical point, but there wasn't any mustache wax. So
yes.
there's a major plot point that had to be changed for that. In between those two movies, there was a television version with David Suchet as
part of the series.
As a series.
There was another adaptation of it
Japanese?
With... it was a TV series that also seemed to be one of the first performances with Jessica Chastain.
Yeah.
But that one had Edward Molino as Poirot.
Well, the thing that I liked about the television version is that it sets up a case before Poirot gets to Istanbul, where he gets on the train, where he's kind of goes sour. He's investigating this theft of funds at the British Army. And he's interrogating this one young man or in a court martial or something. And the young man freaks out and takes a gun and shoots himself, the blood spattering on Quarrel's face. And that kind of, when he arrives in Istanbul, he's tired. He probably just would want to just rest in the hotel room. But then he gets a wire that he needs to go to London. But then the train's booked up. And so he just meets somebody who is on the board of the directors for the Orient Express, and so insists on dragging him on board. And
because
so,
like any world-famous cop, he knows everybody, everywhere.
Yeah, and so it's a very clever way of inserting him into this situation, this conspiracy to murder this man, Ratchet.
Yeah, the problem with the Branagh one is that he tries to turn him into an action hero.
Yeah, there's the pre-credit sequence, kind of like in a James Bond movie.
Yeah. And I think that's because he was directing those Thor movies and other things, and he just got in the habit of... He wanted his own hammer, so he uses his cane as a Thor.
That could be. Or he wanted to get his own sort of action series, the same way Guy Ritchie was doing with Sherlock Holmes, and to use Quarot, though he probably would have been better off doing the 39 Steps or The Lady Vanishes.
Yeah.
Because
that would sustain the lighter feeling that he brings to movies. My problem with... I love his... Henry V, but it too also suffers from a little bit of this you could call shallow theatricality of people with grand voices speaking and everybody basically acting like they're taking a solo turn in a story when there's supposed to be interconnection.
Now, in the Sidney Lumet version in 73, Finney is backed up by an all-star cast. There's Anthony Perkins, Sean Connery, Vanessa Redgrave, Ingrid Bergman, who got an Oscar that year, Jacqueline Bisset, if that's not enough. Martin Balsam is really good in it. Richard Widmark plays the man who's murdered. And there's a couple other actors who are in it. And the way they support the story, their performances are very nicely integrated and drawn out with the editing that really brings you in to the story very well. Whereas with Branagh, he sets up very nice scenes. I mean, there's one where he's interviewing one of the women, And he's got a table set up outside in the snow.
Yeah,
like,
why?
Who set up the table? Who wants to sit on a table out in the snow without a scarf or a coat on?
And then the big reveal at the end is staged as if it's Michelangelo's...
Oh, no, the Da Vinci.
Da Vinci's Last Supper.
Yeah, there's a big, long table that he confronts. And you also got the thing in
that also emphasizes his theatrical approach to things. He's a solo performer, and they're his audience.
Right, there is that. Whereas in the Albert Finney version, they're in this little car, and it's nicely where Finney walks back and forth as they surround him. Now, in the TV version, it's much more dramatic because they realize the train is stalled out in the snow in the Alps or the highlands of Yugoslavia, and their electricity is off. And so Poirot has figured it out, but everybody happens to be crowded around in the car, keeping themselves warm, waiting for the rescue to come. And they're asking him, well, what have you figured it out? Have you solved the mystery? And he has figured it out, the conspiracy that's going on. And he just, like, he doesn't want to say, but they, like, force him to reveal it. And he reveals that he wasn't fooled at all. There was, like, conspirators were trying to fool him with a bunch of stuff on the murder.
Well,
but he wasn't fooled, and he knew before he talked to him what's the solution.
What the story was, because it was based on a famous, it was
the book
a predecessor, there's a preceding case that was world famous that he happened to make the connection. But even more important, he is the cause of why they got caught.
Yeah.
Because one of their team didn't get there, and he got the cabin that person would have had.
Right, and so it's kind of the idea of fate that is stepped in that brings Quarrel on the scene. And the TV series brings that out nicely. And then the way things are resolved at the end, the Lumette version, there's the resolution, and then things just kind of end. Whereas here, there's a bit more talking about what's going to happen later.
There's a spiritual angle.
Based on the previous case that Quarrel had experienced, where the man shoots himself, which is a greater sin. And so is Quarrel responsible for that? And so that sort of weighs on him, like what he should do now that he's exposed this conspiracy.
Well, he's taking this godlike, I've got to make the books add up. I got to get this, balanced a ledger here.
And that's very nicely done in the TV version, I thought, which is a smaller production. So they focus more on the characters. And the actors, they're familiar faces, especially for British television. But I think they all really support the drama very well.
You know, if you're going to get franchises made out of your work, you got to churn out a lot of them. So I don't know how many novels she had, maybe 70.
Yeah.
I'd have to look it up on Wikipedia. But there weren't all that many adaptations of Christie's books.
She didn't
books.
Let things out. That was the Lumet version was one of the first ones they let out.
Yeah, there were maybe 10 or 12 between 1928 and the early 60s. But then with the early 60s comes the floodgate with Miss Marple, and several others, the comedy, the Frank Tashlin one, and and then culminating in this one. And the ABC, the problem is that you got to keep making the movies good.
Yeah.
And that's one of the problems, I think, with the ABC murders. It takes a page out of the recent Sherlock Holmes adaptations.
Oh, this is a recent BBC adaptation of the ABC murders with John Malkovich.
Malkovich.
As
well, the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes's are set in a kind of a dingy, rundown, dark London, and they take a page out of that so that this is a very unsavory world he's inhabiting. There's no lightness, there's no happiness in it. It's a very sad, grim version.
This is a recent version that's come out from the BBC a couple of months ago of the ABC murders, where there's somebody who's committing a series of murders and he's taunting Quarrel. And the Quarrel in this, he's retired. He's past his prime. This is in the 30s, whereas in the 20s is when he was very famous. And his character seems to be mocking him. And then he goes to the police, and the police, they don't want to have anything to do with him because it's been found out that in this version, he's a fraud. Who is this Quarrel? Where did he come from? Nobody in Belgium knows who he is. Nobody in the police department recognizes him. He's brought up. So it's a different kind of take that's on this, and that mainly is taken or happens because, unlike in the books, the character of Captain Hastings is not present. Because in the books, Hastings is the one who remembers Quarrel from Belgium.
He's the Watson, basically, of the
But he also recognizes Quarrel was in the police and had it interaction with him in Europe. And Quarrow ends up in England as a refugee from the German, the rape of Belgium,
which
was a big issue at the start of World War One.
Well,
and that's what this movie is sort of playing on, this recent one with John Malkovich. This is Quarrow, the refugee from the war, and how he's making his way in a new country. And this kind of appeals to other people who have gone to Britain as refugees from other wars since then.
Right.
And so it's Quarrow as the refugees. It's something that's been in the stories, but it's always been a sort of running joke, whereas people will like, oh, he's this Frenchman. No, he's Belgian. Well, what is that saying? It's like he's Belgian. Yeah, he's from this horrible thing that happened in his country, and here we're not even recognizing him as from this country. He's supposed to be fit something else. And so there's a bit of... on the sort of nationalism or racism that's going on. There's these people with the fascist movement are present in this recent version. So it's one of these themes that's being developed in it. And, it's not the same sunny Agatha Christie thing you're used to.
Right. She wrote so many books, but they lend themselves to adaptation in variation. So, if the thing is it has to be good, a good idea, and be done well. I don't feel that way about this one, but just look at And Then There Were None,
which has been done a couple of times.
It was a movie in the 40s with directed by Renee Clair. So that's a light kind of magical one. Then there's one from 1964 with Hugh O'Brien and Shirley Eaton. That's very British, English-y feeling, but not set on a remote island. It's set on an alp, on a ski lodge. But the exact same story. And then more recently, there was a TV series version of it that fleshed out the story over the course of 6 episodes and stayed true to the novel's original ending.
You're listening to Monday Sample. This is Fortunato. We've got DK Holm here. We're kind of talking about Agatha Christie and some adaptations of her famous novel, The Murder on the Orient Express, but also some other things with Quarrow. Here's this recent version of the ABC murders. I think I kind of liked it. I kind of liked the kind of take on it, but made it a little more serious.
That's why we live in America, man.
Yes, that's right. So we can look at British TV shows. But that you can judge for yourself. I don't think it's out on DVD yet, but it may have been showing up on Mystery Masterpiece, they call it now. This recent version, we have the mass murderer, we have the refugee making his way in a new country. Everything's pretty dark, but surprisingly, at the end, there's just a little bit of hope that comes in as things work out. There's a long sort of falling action after the murderer has been captured and revealed and the motives going on. But still, Quarrow holds his secrets in it. But the events of this murderer has affected other people around him and how they go on. So it's a different drama. It's not what you expect. And I had to start watching it a couple of times again because it was pretty murky.
Yeah, that's maybe I was shortchanging it by only watching the first episode and a half.
So it's 3 episodes, and I kind of stuck with it. Though I still have to get into Luther. I haven't gotten in the new season of Luther yet, which is just out. So we're ongoing search for interesting television here. What you were talking about Us? No, he doesn't want to talk about Us. He's here. Let's see. So Murder on the Orient Express, the 1974 version. The thing that I had against it is that they have this scene where the train starts and this waltz comes in. And on the DVD, they're saying, oh, we wanted to have the nostalgia, the glamour.
Ugh.
But everything up to that point, it's very kind of neorealism. He's actually filming in Istanbul. There's the actual ferry that crosses the Bosphorus over to Istanbul that they're on. They're in a hotel where him and Martin Balsam meet. Even though the train station is a place in Paris, he really works it to make it look like it's in Istanbul. But then when the train starts, this music, which just doesn't fit with this train of death that's setting off.
I know. And you go to a train movie, you want to hear a train.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of train movies, and masterpieces like The Train with Burt Lancaster and others.
Yeah.
But this one is not a great train movie. It's basically just a rolling stage
platform. Yeah, but otherwise...
But it's a good adaptation
of the book. Finney is really good. The cast is nicely balanced. All big stars, but they all really worked together. And Lumet really does a very good job. Again, the ending kind of drops off, but that's kind of how the book is.
Yeah, no, it's just I reread the book, too, because it only takes about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
The book ends really abruptly. Okay, you did it.
Okay.
Well, here's the station. Bye, everybody.
I like that. The thing with the Branna version, he doesn't seem to... The character like figures it out as he's confronting these people, whereas everyone else had it all figured out beforehand. And then he's like, oh, there's been a killing on the Nile. We need you to go there. It's like they're trying to set up
the next, because Death on the Nile was the second one in the series, but the first one with...
Peter Ustinov.
Yes.
Yeah. So they did a bunch of films after that. For the Michael Sousette version, the TV versions, I mean, pretty much every one of them is a very good view. When they do the novels, I really like the version of Five Little Pigs.
Mm.
It's probably a very one of his most difficult cases, where this is murder that happened 8 years earlier, mm-hmm. and it's just he has to take everyone's remembrances and put together what happened.
Yeah, that's what sounds like one of the more obscure of the Christie novels. I haven't even heard of that one.
Yeah, and it's got a very good cast in it. Some people that you'd recognize from Game of Thrones and some other stuff like that are in it. That's a really good series. But I'm sorry that it seems like Branna wanted to like kickstart his own series, kind of like Robert Downey Jr. and Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
But it seems to... If he shaved off the mustache, we'd go for another Murder on the Nile, but I don't know.
I don't think even if he cast it with somebody else as Poirot, it would work. His approach doesn't respect the material.
Right. It seemed like each different actor, he sort of set up a special sort of way of doing them. There was one, the character who was playing the secretary. They're always kind of closed in and shadowy. And then he's talking to this one woman. And like I said, he sets it up outside or in an open... boxcar.
Sheer craziness.
And then these other things, they don't really match.
No.
In the beginning, where they all get on the train, it's this big, elaborate tracking shot that's just there for the sake of a tracking shot. You know, the opening of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, you see the bomb in a close-up, then you see it put in a trunk, then you follow this car as it's passing and
it's telling the story.
The story.
It's not just showing off their budget.
And then later in this apartment, we follow Charlton Heston through the apartment as he goes into the bathroom, accidentally knocks over this empty shoebox. Then we follow him back out. And then still within the shot, somebody comes in and says, hey, we found the dynamite. It's in this shoebox. And Heston goes, looked in that.
And what's
shoebox.
Great about that, we know what Heston knows and what one of the other characters is trying to fool everybody with. And in fact,
I love the line that Welles gives. He goes, I know how you feel. He's like, wait a minute. I looked in that box. There was no evidence in that. And Welles is, I know how you feel. Calm down. I know how you feel.
That shot was arguably more complicated to shoot than the other long take at the start of the movie.
Yeah, because there was different actors coming in.
Coming and going,
apartment that they... It looked like it was actually filmed in that apartment or something.
Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, it's hard to tell on that. But Touch of Evil, that's a movie that's always worth going back to see. But... see any of the Michael Sousette Quarros and the Albert Finney Murder on the Orient Express. And there's the following series, which is pretty good for whodunits and stuff.
Yes.
Well, we're getting near the end here. Aiden wants to come on and put on Democracy Now, right? Right, he wants to do that. Let's see, what do we got? Well, let's see here. We'll find a few songs here to end things out. This is one of my favorites here. We haven't played any postmodern jukebox yet.
No.
Yeah.
And that show's almost over.
Home is where I want to be. Pick me up and turn me around. I feel numb. Born with a weak heart. I guess I must be having fun. The less we say about it, the better. Make it up as we go along. Feet on the ground, head in the sky. It's okay, I know nothing's wrong. Nothing's wrong. guess I'm already there. I come home, he lifted up his wings. I guess that this must be the place. Oh, and I can't tell one from another, that I find you or you find me. There was a time before we were born, and someone asked, this is where.
Talking Heads, this must be the place. What was that movie? That was the concert movie, Talking Heads. Stop Making Sense.
Yes. apparently, I stopped making sense.
David Byrne sang this song with a lamp, a standing lamp. Uh-huh. He danced around it. I love that. This is one of my favorite songs. I'm glad that they did it here. Well, this has been the singer-songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler. Ed will be back next month on the first Monday of the month, unless something else comes up. This has been Fortunato and DK Holm.
Yay.
And let's see.
And Young Aiden.
Young Aiden. He's going to be back here with
Democracy Now.
He was telling us about this game, and of course he ran out before we turned the microphone on. So that's the way it's been going here. I hope you've been having a good afternoon. Thanks for listening. Thanks for everyone who called in with answers to our questions here and everything. We'll be back next week. Miss Jess, just Jess, should be with us. Maybe Miss Godiva Lee, our fangirl at large, who will have she went to a Wizard Con. Orcs was given a panel about how you create things for your games setting. So we'll talk about that. So we'll have a full house here next time here on the Monday Sampler. Stay tuned for Democracy Now. So long. I feel as if I am a cog.
Short intermission. We'll see you in about 15 minutes.